Chicagoradio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
Chicago. Jakarta. Helsinki. Cape Town. Sao Paulo. Manchester. Bangalore. And somewhere in Russia, I can't actually remember the name.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, most of us have probably forgotten entirely about Guantanamo Bay Prison, set up so long ago to confine the worst of the worst in George Bush Jr.'s global war on terror. Incredibly, all these years later, prisoners still languish there without the benefit of the protection of laws that were once the pride of Western civilization. Andy Worthington remembers, though, and more. He's been working all these years to both publicize the plight of those held and get them real justice. Well, last week he attended in London one of the 10 coordinated global vigils for the closure of Guantanamo. He reminds 16 of the 30 men still held after having been are still held there after having been approved for release as of November 1st, between 404 and 531 days, more now. Andy, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Chris. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, yeah, we'll see about that. Your article, Andy, up at your website, photos and report the coordinated global vigils for the closure of Guantanamo on November 1st, 2023. That's up at andyworthington.co.uk. Firstly, what are these vigils and who is the coordinating hand behind them?
Okay, so the vigils really came out of vigils that we've been holding in London since last September. And they themselves are a kind of revival of vigils that used to take place in London for many years earlier in Guantanamo's history, with some incredibly energetic people who used to meet outside Parliament once a week. Well, that wasn't feasible, but we thought, well, once a month is a good idea. So we started doing it last September. Then in January this year, of course, it was the anniversary, the 21st anniversary of the opening of Guantanamo. So, you know, there's a lot of action around that time around the world. And then I thought, well, we need to try and keep this going. So I suggested to some of my activist friends in various places that they might like to join us in London in holding coordinated monthly vigils for the closure of Guantanamo across the United States, in Mexico City, in various cities in Europe. And people have come on board. So that's what we do. And I'm really glad to say we started it in February. It's still going. And, you know, and I think it's just one of those things that you do that is an important reminder that it hasn't gone away, that not everyone has forgotten. It doesn't involve huge numbers of people. But as we know, you know, there's a huge difference between nobody turning up and a handful of people bothering to make their presence felt. So that's what we do.
Well, and Andy, now that I just mentioned it in the intro, but, you know, more than half of the men remaining have been totally cleared to leave, and yet There they are. They're still hanging around. How is that possible?
Well, it's possible, Chris, because they're not held on any kind of legal basis. You know, this may come as a surprise to people. You know, those of us who know the history of Guantanamo know that it was set up lawlessly to hold people indefinitely without charge or trial, with the intention of, you know, of also having some shoddy trials that would approve evidence derived from torture and swiftly lead to the execution of people that they said were terrorists. That didn't happen. You know, the handful of people accused of serious crimes are caught up in an endless groundhog day of pre-trial hearings that really doesn't function, because the defense lawyers are doing their job, which is to expose what happened to their clients, which is torture in the CIA black sites. And the prosecutors are trying to hide that. So it just goes round and round. But the majority of the men held at Guantanamo have always been held indefinitely without charge or trial. And various administrative review processes have taken place over the years to assess whether, you know, groups of military officers and intelligence people think that they should continue to be held. The only time this was broken was a two-year period from 2008 to 2010, when the prisoners actually secured habeas corpus rights and lawyers were able to go before district court judges and present evidence. And in a few dozen cases, the judges ruled that the government had failed to establish in any way that these people had any meaningful connection to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban and ordered them released. That golden period, that two-year period, the only time the law properly applied at Guantanamo, was brought to an end by a handful of right-wing appeals court judges who, in a number of decisions, changed the rules on habeas so that it was impossible for prisoners to have habeas corpus petitions granted. For all that time, since 2010, we've been back in this system where the only way that you can be approved for release from Guantanamo is through administrative review processes, and they're not legally binding. That's the crucial thing. So the government approves you for release from Guantanamo, having decided that you don't constitute a significant security threat, and then they find it difficult to release you, or they can't really be bothered to process the paperwork. And there's no way that anyone can force them to do it. There is no judge that the prisoners can go to say, excuse me, Your Honor, I've been approved for release from this hellhole, but I can't seem to get out. Can you nudge the government to do something about it? So they're entirely at the mercy of, how would you call it? The whim of the executive, I suppose, as it was when the prison was first set up. And that's what I've been trying to make clear recently, really, is that these men, extraordinarily, the ones who've never been charged, even more than the ones who have been charged, are still as fundamentally without any basic rights as they were when the prison first opened nearly 22 years ago.
Yeah, I guess I'd put it the political vagaries of the moment. I mentioned in the introduction, Andy, that what has happened there has threatened those cherished legal precepts upon which Western civilization was built. You're English, and the main one is habeas corpus in the English, founded in the English common law 8-something centuries ago now. Yeah. For those that don't speak Latin, Andy, can you just briefly explain what habeas corpus is and what it means to the law and to all of us to see this vital bit of legislation cast out so unceremoniously?
Well, it means you have the body and what it set up. The barons under King John, insisted that you couldn't be slung in a dungeon at the whim of the executive, which was the king at the time, without a jury, a trial, and a jury of your peers. So it's the fundamental guarantee that you're safe from executive overreach, which ironically is, what the Americans who broke free from England did when they founded the United States in 1776. And have subsequently forgotten. I mean, it's so absolutely crucial, and it's always really been the cornerstone of why I was interested in Guantanamo and why I've refused to let the topic go. Because in a dictatorship, you can be thrown in a dungeon and no one cares about habeas corpus. In countries that claim to respect the law, you're only allowed to be deprived of your liberty through two means. One is that you're charged with a crime and put on trial, and the other is that you're a prisoner of war in wartime. And what the Bush administration did was to throw all of this away and decide that what they had was a category of human beings with no rights whatsoever, who without any review process whatsoever were determined to be enemy combatants who could be held indefinitely, as I say, without charge or trial and had no rights. That's the fundamental situation at Guantanamo, and that's the really quite shocking truth about how four presidents in this situation still hasn't been dealt with, because we're faced with this glaring problem of men approved for release, never charged, held for up to 22 years, who can't get out of that prison because they're not actually in any kind of legal process. They're just in some kind of administrative bubble.
Yes, and while the citizens of England, that green and pleasant land, were enjoying the protection of habeas corpus granted by King John, and he was the guy with the pointy beard that you see in the Robin Hood movies, the very same, those continentals that were not enjoying that right, like in Spain, would see under the Spanish Inquisition, that nobody in England expects, that people were tortured, had their bits burned and pulled apart and so on for confessions. And that was the way they were doing law there at the same time.
Yes, the early precursor of the CIA black sites.
Yes. And this, it seems, now that would be cast away so that we would be moving headlong back in time through the future towards the past, this terrible past, a time before King John granted habeas corpus under the pressure, as you describe, of the noble peers of old England.
Yeah. And, you know, what's shameful about it, Chris, is that, you know, throughout all of this and, throughout Obama's years and Biden's years, obviously we can forget about Trump. But all through this period, the option has always been there for the administration via the Justice Department to simply address this through the law by not challenging the habeas corpus petitions of men that it wants to release from Guantanamo. Then they could be freed. Then they would be able to put pressure on the administration to actually go ahead and release them. Then the United States could say that it was recognizing the laws that had been so appallingly shunned and disposed of after 9/11. But they haven't done it. They've never done it. They hate the courts wading in any way to suggest that there's been any wrongdoing at Guantanamo. Hence the reason that we're stuck with these administrative processes instead. You know, it was extremely significant this year that that a UN rapporteur got to visit Guantanamo for the first time. It hadn't happened before because the US would never guarantee that they wouldn't be kept under scrutiny, and the special mandates are not allowed to go unless they're guaranteed that they can talk to prisoners freely. And what she discovered, you know, really, I think, shocked the administration. They thought they'd, they thought they were the good guys because they'd finally come up with the circumstances to allow the UN to visit and that they would get a, you know, they get a pretty decent report for having improved conditions and doing their best. But what she found was that the circumstances in which the men are held haven't really, in really crucial ways, haven't changed since the prison opened. So these men are kept under 24-hour surveillance. They are persistently dehumanized. They are still moved in heavy shackles around the prison whenever they're moved anywhere. They are not allowed proper, meaningful contact with their families. All of this, you know, this is in addition to the whole broken legal process. But all of this in the treatment of the men, it's not even as though it's deliberate. It's that no one along the way bothered to scrutinize it properly to see that what was happening was still the same hysterical, brutal overreaction to the men that it was holding. As it was when the prison first opened. So, you know, that report has been absolutely devastating, and it's not the only one from the UN this year. There have been a number of reports by working groups on arbitrary detention and other aspects of the special mandate's job, which have also absolutely damned the United States for what it's doing. But, you know, most people haven't even heard about this, Chris. You know, it's barely reported in the mainstream media. When it is, you know, it will only be in a few outlets, and it's here one minute and gone the next. I struggle to know what to say about how we proceed with this, except to hope that that the Biden administration is paying attention, because they've got a year left now, really, just over a year, to try and resolve this to the best of their ability. to be remembered with some fondness, at least on this issue, that they made significant steps towards the closure of Guantanamo. And that does mean absolutely finding new homes for these men who are held and have been cleared for release. And the problem, I should say, Chris, is that the majority of them cannot be sent back to their home countries, which in most cases is Yemen, because there is a ban imposed every year in the National Defense Authorization Act by Republicans, which Democrats agree with, of not sending people back to Yemen. And in fact, it isn't safe to send people back to Yemen. But they have to find third countries who will take them in, and no one wants to do it. And unfortunately, what we know is that when Majid Khan, who, you know, as a young man in a very confused state, had been drawn into Al-Qaeda and had actually worked as a courier transferring money that was used to fund terrorist plots, he was put on trial in the military commissions. He took a plea deal, and eventually when his sentence came to an end, he had to be released. Now, you understand, with a plea deal in a functioning legal system or an attempt at a functioning legal system, the United States can't mess about. They had to find somewhere to send this man. He couldn't be sent back to Pakistan. He was resettled in Belize earlier this year, and he has been resettled there comfortably, as is appropriate. But, you know, the United States spent money and exerted considerable diplomatic and political effort to resettle this man. And yet the men they're holding who are approved for release but who are nobodies, they can't really be bothered to go out their way to do anything to help them. It's just another example of the hideous moral mess that Guantanamo is.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Andy Worthington. Andy's a freelance investigative journalist, activist, author, photographer. His photojournalism project is The State of London. He's a filmmaker and songwriter, the lead singer and the main songwriter for the London-based band The Forefathers, whose music you can get at Bandcamp. He's the co-founder of the Close Guantanamo Campaign. And he's the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, and Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, and the Battle of the Beanfield. This is from your website. I'm just reading. I usually write this up, but I could just keep on going, and then we'd be totally out of time. And I don't want to do that. Of course, Julian Assange would know all about the lack of habeas corpus. He's been imprisoned in Belmarsh all this time. Still, I don't know. He's still waiting to go to court somewhere, sometime. But Andy, we were talking off air about what's going on in Gaza right now. I was talking in the first half with lawyer Bill Geimer about this as well. And you mentioned the administrative detention or the administrative procedures that's used in Guantanamo. We've seen this in Israel, too, this administrative detention where thousands of Palestinian men, women, and children have been taken, kidnapped, essentially, off the streets. They receive no trial. They don't even have charges in many cases and are just held as hostages. Yeah. When Hamas has said that part of the reason for their October 7th prison break and attack on bases and residents near the wall area was to secure hostages as bargaining chips to get some of these people, or all of them, released. So here we see again this idea of habeas corpus being thrown out the window, leading to this in the most extreme example. I've been watching, Andy, we've been having demonstrations here in my town in Victoria and in other places in Canada, and we've seen it around the world. And in London, it's been absolutely stunning. I expect you got pictures and were taking part there. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, Chris. I mean, the only heartening thing to come out of all of this is the realization that millions of people are prepared to get out on the streets. But even more than that, that tens of millions, hundreds of millions, possibly even billions of people around the world, out of our grand population of 8 billion people, are more fundamentally appalled by what they're being presented with on their screens every day than they have been by anything in their lifetimes. You know, the systematic genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza. Now, it hasn't formally been termed a genocide yet, because obviously, human rights experts have to sift through evidence before they can make a pronouncement. But I would be extremely surprised if it isn't eventually judged to be a genocide, because this is just out-and-out slaughter of Palestinian civilians day after day after day after day. It's absolutely horrendous. The marches here in London have been massive. They have, of course, been, you know, almost entirely well-behaved. These are human beings coming together to defend humanity against what is something that I think most of us, you know, have never seen, because genocide is the darkness at the heart of humanity, which is supposed to take place away from prying eyes. This is in full view of the world, and this is, I think, the you know, a sign of the absolute moral sickness of the Zionist project, that they're so unaware of how vile their actions are that they're even prepared to show it to the whole world. It's beyond disgusting, really.
Well, and the effects, and I talked with Bill Geimer a little bit about this too, but the effects that this is having on our countries, on Canada, on Britain, France, the G7, Canada's foreign minister, Melanie Joly, Genocide Joly, as we like to call her here, is standing in front of the world press at the G7 and saying that the G7 countries are united in our condemnation of Hamas's terrorist attack on Israel, and we support humanitarian pauses in the bombing, she means, just for a moment, and reiterate our support for the war in Ukraine and blah, 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 you know. But what we see here is not only is it being presented in front of our eyes in the media, but our own governments, the parliament in Canada is 100%. There's not a single member standing in opposition saying stop this right now. What's it like in Britain?
Well, not one at all, Chris. That's extraordinary. No, here we've got nearly 100 MPs that are, or maybe even over 100 MPs. So about 1/6 of the parliament is calling for a ceasefire, you know, which isn't enough. But the problem that we're facing here, of course, is that both of our major parties support it. And, you know, and the problem in the United States, of course, is that both major parties support it. So we're in an interesting time politically, because both the Labour Party here, which hopes to win the next election, and Joe Biden in the US, who hopes to win the next election, could lose because of Muslim voters and because of other people who remember their humanity, who simply won't vote for them. I don't know what's going to happen. I think here in the UK, there's an opportunity from the exiled members of the Labour Party, people like Jeremy Corbyn, who've been kicked out, and also I would suggest in constituencies with a high Muslim population that independents should stand, and that, you know, that they may very well be able to defeat either Labour or Tory challengers, which would, you know, that would be interesting. What about if we had dozens and dozens of independent, decent left-wing MPs, not aligned to a party, but possibly then, after the next election, holding a significant, you know, sway of maybe holding power, actually, between two parties, neither of which have a majority. I don't know. I mean, I've been thinking about all of these things, but I think what's absolutely clear, and I don't know how much this is going to go away, is that there are so many of us who cannot embrace any of these people who have crossed the red line. Any of these people who are endorsing what is happening in Gaza right now have lost their humanity. They've lost their right to represent us in any kind of way. I mean, this is not just in the political sphere. This is in, you know, the entertainment sphere. This is all kinds of people who seem oblivious to the fact, or don't care, that they've crossed a line that involves our essential humanity. I think it's really as profound and as clear as that. But then, you know, but then we don't know what the future holds, do we? I mean, you know, we apparently, you know, persistently going to be failed by our leaders who are basically saying, well, 10,000 isn't enough. It's like, well, what is that, 20,000? I mean, nothing on this scale has happened, certainly not ever in public like this before. What does Israel hasn't got a plan. Israel's plan is a mixture of genocide and forced displacement. But its forced displacement plan has a problem, which is that Egypt controls the door and doesn't want, you know, the unthinkable to happen, which is that Israel gets to expel 2.3 million people somewhere else because it wants to win its outrageous 75-year-old battle to steal the whole of the country from the Palestinians who were there before. I don't know how it's going to be resolved. Nobody does. Israel hasn't got an actual plan here. All they're doing at the moment is indulging to the max the genocidal fantasies on which the state of Israel was founded 75 years ago. And the world is still allowing it. But it's not over by a long way, Chris.
Well, how about that resilience? Is there an organization in London? I mean, will people be out every Saturday? Will we see these? I mean, I imagine the numbers will just dwindle and dwindle, that I fear. Although the last demo here in my town was the biggest yet. But I fear that it's going to just peter out.
It's Armistice Day on Saturday. So the government tried to get the police to ban it, which they're allowed to do if they fear serious unrest. And the police turned around and said, we don't fear serious unrest. When it's not our position to ban it according to the law. And so it's going to go ahead, but it will be bigger than ever. And it would be even bigger than ever had it been banned. But that might have, who knows what it would have happened in that case. I mean, at the moment, I'm just extremely pleased that the police has been, I mean, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, our Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, who is genuinely, you know, evil. Yeah. She refers to the Palestinian marches as hate marches. And he was asked about it, and he said she appears to have chosen two words randomly and put them together. Yeah. Devastating barb that was at her.
Well, it's funny, but I don't think it's true. Obviously, she was thought very carefully about using these tropes. Did you know, Andy, and we're fast out of time, but there was somebody actually arrested in Calgary, I read, here within the last couple of days, at a demo, because they were chanting, or somewhere, I don't have the details, but they were chanting from the river to the sea and were arrested supposedly because that was an anti-Semitic threat. And so this is in Canada, in Calgary.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, this stuff has to be resisted so massively, Chris, because otherwise this is the opening for types of fascism in our countries, coming from people who don't believe that they're fascists. I mean, you know, how appropriate when what they're doing is the bidding of the Israeli government, who are fascists but don't see that they're fascists. I mean, it's, you know, these are difficult and dangerous times, but we, you know, we have to stand up for our rights for freedom of speech, and we have to stand up for people who are getting sacked for sending out a tweet saying that they're opposed to genocide, for example, which is happening all over the place. I mean,
in Canada. Yeah, that's happening here too. Well, it's just the greasy skid to the democracy's oblivion. Okay, well, Andy, we're fast out of time. AndyWorthington.co.uk. You can go to his site to read his articles, see his pictures, get connections to his music and his band, the Forefathers, and support his work. It's been ongoing for many, many years. Thanks a lot for coming on, Andy, and thanks to William S. Geimer as well. I look forward to our next discussion, though I fear the topic as ever.
You're not running a good news show generally, though, are you, Chris? But, you know, it would be nice for the world to slightly come back from the brink of where it is at the moment, because this is really kind of worse than anything I've seen.
Agreed. Yeah, me too. And I've been at this for quite a while as well.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much. I enjoyed being with you.
Until the next time then, Andy.
Cheers, Chris. Bye-bye. Adios.
That's all I got for this week.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire.
This year's fund drive is over, but the link to donate is still live at cgsf.ca. patreon.com/donate. If you missed supporting our campaign in real time, it's not too late. Donate now, and thank you.